Hello, and welcome to the broadcast. This is the 22nd episode of The Truth Is No Defense. Just a brief announcement about next week's show. We'll be joined by a special guest from Germany. We'll be speaking about contemporary German politics and culture, German white power music, the Third Reich, and much more. It's not so much an interview as a conversation. I hope you stay tuned for this episode. Our culture here in America, unlike Germany's, I hope, has become so revolting that often I simply cannot bear to leave the home. Like so many other suburbanites, I lead a quiet life, but one where I'm always looking over my shoulder. I tend to my yard, write, and enjoy family life, keeping clear of the undertow which might sweep me out to sea with the rest of the quas, flotsam, and jetsam. I'd like to enjoy life and its beauty for as long as possible, before the deluge drowns all of white America. So rather than swim against the tide, I've chosen to simply stay on the beach and wait for the high tide to come. Yet no one can hide for long. What's happening now is simply the first wave, preceding a larger tsunami, which shall wash away all in its wake. What you see now, this swell of raceless urban lemmings, donned with baggy pants, backward baseball caps, is merely the beach break, churning ocean foam at the edge of a hurricane. Whether we recognize it or not, what has happened is a disintegration of civil society. Many, even white nationalists, don't understand this, though most know something is terribly wrong. They have a visceral revulsion, a bad feeling, a feeling something is out of place, perhaps like seeing a nigger drive a BMW. William Pierce saw this phenomenon as alienation. Whites deprived of the ordered and selective environment in which the best of our race can excel, pulling up the weaker. Instead, the weakest and the lowest rungs of subhumans are pulling whites down into the mud. Just how far, how demotic, how debased our culture is, was concretized for me during a recent visit to a shopping mall. It could have been any number of things: race-mixing blonde girls, roving packs of niggers, or low-riding Mexicans. But what turned my stomach the most was a female Mexican creature. In her brood were four kids, and they all looked just like her, short, fat, brown, and shaped like beer kegs, with stubby appendages for arms, legs, and a head. The mother's head, in particular, resembled an overinflated balloon, something shaped like a pear. It was fatter at the bottom where the jaws and mouth are, and smaller at the top where the brains reside. Somehow this thing had pulled a snugly fitting t-shirt down onto her bloated torso. Printed on this t-shirt was a large logo, a USDA meat inspection stamp. Underneath that logo, if it weren't so disgusting, it really would be funny. Underneath that logo were the words USDA Choice Prime Cut Meat. Really, it was all too much for my stomach. I can laugh about it now, but I wanted to puke then. It was ugly beyond description. Yet such ugliness is ubiquitous. We live in an ugly culture, one that revels and celebrates its ugliness. There may be time for some nations of Europe, like Germany perhaps, to pull themselves away from the brink of disaster. But that time has passed for America. We are finished. White America, as white America, is gone. We may be able to carve out some microstate for ourselves. But as a macro entity, we are finished. A critical mass has been reached. A paradigm shift has been completed. We are now transformed into something radically different than that what we were for the last 200 years. We, as white nationalists, must understand the rules have changed. The ballpark is a different one. We must play this game differently. You know, a brown America simply cannot enjoy broad-based economic prosperity. Wealth in the third world converges into the hands of a few. In the third world, to which America now belongs, wealth is taken from the populace at large and put into the hands of a market-dominant minority. For instance, in Africa, subcontinent Indians, or dotheads, are the most dominant economic minority, controlling most of the market for goods there. In Southeast Asia, it is the Chinese. It is argued the U.S. does not have a market-dominant minority, but I think this is a deliberate oversight, for Jews have long since elbowed out whites in control of the media and many retail sectors. Regardless, third world states like the New America or the Kwa, along with those in Africa and Asia, have not, nor have they ever, developed an organized labor movement. Business interests in Africa and Asia are free to do as they wish, with little regard for even workplace safety rules. This often works for the benefit of global capitalist entities. Though for some industries, the transformation of America into a third world state has not been a boom, but a bust. As America is flooded with low IQ third world brown types from Mexico and Africa, we just can't expect a workforce with much initiative, with much motivation, or the ability to adapt. This, I think, is the untold reason for much of the trouble General Motors now finds itself. As has been widely reported in the business press, GM and Ford are facing bankruptcy. Their cars aren't selling, and their bonds are categorized as junk. In the past, old stock Americans of English, German, Polish, and other European stock manned the factories of GM and Ford. But today, niggers, Mexicans, and their racially mixed debris are replacing white workers. Human quality, when it comes to a workforce, is especially important when competing against homogeneous nations like Germany and Japan. It is true that GM and Ford's healthcare concessions to the unions imperiled their finances. Yet, in concrete terms, just who comprises the unions? According to the president of the UAW, the nation's largest automotive workers' union, its president affirms, quote, "We have to reflect those people we work for, African Americans, Hispanics, Arabs, you name it. The UAW is not just a union, but we're also a social movement." And I suppose what he means by being a social movement is the UAW sides with big business to keep whites locked out of jobs and higher education. Recently, as witnessed in the Grutter versus Bollinger case, which originated in Michigan, Barbara Grutter, a white female, with a 3.8 GPA and a 161 SAT, was rejected by the University of Michigan Law School. She filed suit alleging that the university had discriminated against her on the basis of race. She said she was rejected because the law school used race as the predominant factor, giving niggers and Mexicans and other applicants a significantly greater chance of admission than white students. The UAW joined with a roster of Fortune 500 companies, which included Microsoft, Intel, American Airlines, Procter & Gamble, PepsiCo, and others, to keep in place laws barring whites' access to university education. I cannot think of any influential political organ which has not succumbed to multicultural orthodoxy, or simply hatred of whites. One might ask, how has diversity and multiculturalism helped labor unions? Since the desegregation of the unions, their influence in government has not increased, but decreased, and even membership has declined. Labor unions have been unable to stop NAFTA, CAFTA, or any other job-exporting trade policies signed into law by both Democrat and Republican presidents. Ironically, the more labor unions fail, the more they cling to policies and people which are weakening them. It is a suicidal dynamic. This suicidal dynamic is really a paradigm. This new paradigm has captured all parts of government, business, and even civil society itself. It's not just labor unions. Why any white man pays dues or supports labor unions, or for that matter joins the U.S. military, demonstrates a failure of white nationalists to convey our message to the populace. For those old enough to remember a cleaner, more orderly white America, these changes are very painful. Yet, for the younger, many, whether they are racially conscious or not, now see this ugliness as normal, for it is all they have ever known. I suppose it is from this foundation, this new paradigm, we as white nationalists must proceed. We must see ourselves as underdogs, as insurgents, as minorities, if you will. Just recalling or remembering the old republic or white America is not enough. Nostalgia will not save our people. In fact, it paralyzes action. Sure, I'd like to have my chance to see the system crack open. I'd like to have the chance to fight, to take vengeance upon our enemies. Though it is just as likely this new paradigm is here to stay. If so, we as whites must organize as racially conscious whites, as our competitors have already done for their race. Thanks for listening tonight.